Welcome to the fourth annual Access lecture at University College, and may I welcome our speaker this evening, Professor Les Ebden. I want to tell you a little bit about him. Much of his career has been a career in which he has come more and more to recognise the importance of education institutions as vehicles of social mobility in this country. He went to Imperial to read chemistry. He was the first in his family to go to university. He then taught and researched at Makerere in Uganda, and then in what in those days were the polytechnics in Sheffield and in Plymouth, all places where the impact of education on and higher education on those who came from communities and came from families with no tradition of higher education at all was very marked and very obvious. He was appointed Vice Chancellor at the University of Luton, as it was then called, it's now the University of Bedfordshire, in 2003, which I think it's fair to say thrived under his leadership, and really from then on has been a leading figure in higher education policy making circles. He's been a particularly eloquent advocate for widening participation and for fair access, notably from the pulpit that was given to him as chair of the million plus group of universities. Million, I should say, stands for having millions of students. It doesn't stand for the size of the surpluses of those universities. And then last September he succeeded Sir Martin Harris as director of OFFA, the Office for Fair Access. And on the day of his appointment, he said, "As director, I fully intend to respect institutional autonomy and the diversity of the sector, working with both institutions and other sector bodies to understand what works best in improving access and retention, and so make sure that the substantial investment in access measures has the greatest possible impact." And since then, there have been one or two hints of what Professor Ebden thinks might work, or at least ought to be tried. So he is a champion of the use of contextual social and economic information when making admissions decisions. He has said that universities ought to be extending their outreach activities to primary schools and should do far more to raise the aspirations of young children. I know that he is interested in the feasibility of using the tracking of the educational progress of quite young children as a way of identifying and indeed nurturing natural abilities. So we already have some hints of what Professor Ebden might say. But they're only hints, and I dare say there's a great deal more. So we're all looking forward to listening to what you have to say.
Well, thank you very much indeed, Ivor, and thank you for such a generous introduction. It's a great pleasure to be here. But that introduction did remind me of a conversation that I had with my children. My eldest son said, "Dad, when you're lying in your coffin and people are filing past, what is it you'd most like to hear?" And I said, "Oh." And he said, "I know what it is, Dad." He said, "You'd like them to hear that you were a great reforming vice chancellor who did amazing things for access and widening participation as well." "No, not really." And my younger son said, "I know what it is, Dad. You'd like to hear somebody say, he was a great chemist. He made amazing contributions to our understanding of trace metals speciation by directly coupled mass spectrometry. And I said, well, not really. And my daughter said, I know what it really would be, Dad. You'd like somebody to say, he was a great father and a wonderful grandfather. And I said, well, no, not really. So they said, well, Dad, what is it? And you'd like to hear, we were fighting past a coffin. I said, it would be nice if just one person said, look, he's breathing.
He's breathing.
And famously, of course, in those press cuttings that the Master's been looking through, it is said I don't know very much about Oxford colleges, and so I will demonstrate that tonight. But I've been trying to remedy my deficiencies in that area, learning fast as Director of Fair Access. And I know that University College Oxford was founded in the 13th century. Even the taxi driver confirmed that to me. You are the oldest college in Oxford or Cambridge, but you were relatively late to accept undergraduate students, I gather, only in the 16th century. But by the end of the 16th century, some benefactors had endowed enough undergraduate scholarships for the access work here to begin. So you have a 400-year history of access, although only, I note, in 1979 did the college admit women. I can see from tonight things have changed a good deal. And indeed, I can reflect on the contrast there is now between today and the 1970s, women were once underrepresented in higher education, and now it is men who are underrepresented in higher education. And one of the many successes of widening participation in higher education. But having shown that I've done my homework on you, let me check out that you know your homework on me about the Office of the for Fair Access. The role of the office is, as the stated there, to promote and safeguard fair access to higher education for people from lower income backgrounds and other underrepresented groups. And the way that we do this is not the way that the Vega Manor describes it, but actually by getting universities and colleges to submit access agreements to say if they want to charge above the base fee, what they will do to promote access from people from lower income backgrounds and other underrepresented groups. So it is the universities and the colleges who set the targets, not the director. But I have discovered that I have to approve every single access agreement, and I'm not allowed to depute that to anyone else. You have to have my approval to charge over £6,000 fees for a full-time student. That access agreement, as I say, sets out what you'll do to make sure that underrepresented groups are not discouraged from applying. We also monitor your performance against the targets which you've set yourself on an annual basis. And that access agreement contains fee information. It contains the measures which you're going to take to promote access. It will have the aims that you have in terms of your access and widening participation policy, the targets which you're setting yourself, and the milestones on the way to those targets. So, for example, if you have targets related to primary school activity, then clearly we are not going to wait 10 years to see what transpires. We are expecting there to be some intermediate milestones. One of the things that we have been pressing upon people is the value of evaluation of how well the access agreement is going, and also the importance of student consultation in putting together the access agreement. We are very keen to make sure that accurate and full information is available for prospective students. And of course, these days there are colleges and universities responsibilities as public bodies under the Equalities Act 2010 to make sure that groups with protected characteristics are not inadvertently disadvantaged by your policies. And so there is already going on in the university an evaluation of the impact of what you do on those protected groups. And we will ask you to replicate that. We're asking you to tell us how that is working out in terms of your access agreement. Is your access policy actually assisting your performance under the Equalities Act 2010? And recently the government issued a white paper, Students at the Heart of the System, and they asked offer to provide active and energetic challenge and support to universities and colleges. And I've characterised my time as the director of the office as a time of greater challenge and greater support. And I hope that will become clear as I talk this evening. Now let's start with the good news. There's been some good progress in widening participation in recent years. There's been a significant improvement in participation. In fact, there's been a good increase in the poorest group, poorest quintile going to university, an increase of about a third in participation from such students. Albeit from a very low base, but we can see that increase. The latest UCAS figures for applications for 2013 came out this week, and we can make a comparison with 2004, when the office was established, when for every 10 students who applied from disadvantaged areas, there were 45 applications to university from advantaged areas. That's adjusting for differences in population size. In 2017, for those 10 applications for disadvantaged areas, there are now 27 from advantaged areas. So we've seen a significant improvement in the ratio of applications coming from disadvantaged areas. Not because there's been an enormous tumble in the applications from advantaged areas, but because there has been a significant growth in people in disadvantaged areas, and the POLA 2 classification, to be specific, who have applied to university. But that application has not been to all universities, and there is a particular challenge with selective universities. But it's worth noting that students from the most disadvantaged areas are now 80% more likely to apply to university than they were 9 years ago when the Office for Fair Access was established. But there are still very sharp differences between ratios of applications from different groups. And I show the quintiles of participation by POLAR 2 classification, and you can see that the red line has, maybe if I press it again it'll go away. I did want to press that one, to show that the level of participation from the least advantage group, most disadvantaged group, 20%, is significantly less than the most advantaged 20%. Now let's see if we can get back to what we wanted. That's not coming up. Anyone on the next button? There we go. When I produced this slide, I was basing it on figures from UCAS and the comparing the possibility that you would get into a highly selective university if you came from the 20% of most advantaged people in this country, compared to your chances if you came from the 40% most disadvantaged. So, not looking at a small number, 40% most disadvantaged. And the ratio had for many years been 1 in 6. But in recent years it has slipped to 1 in 7. So we're 7 times more likely to get to a highly selective university if you came from the 20% most advantaged part of the population than the 40% most disadvantaged. Interestingly now, the UCAS end of cycle figures in 2012 show that ratio, which had been moving upwards from 1 in 6 to 1 in 7, has slipped back now to 1 in 5.8. Now we have to put some caveats around that, because that's just UCAS data, and not everybody gets into university through UCAS. It's very early days to have that. We must also say that last year was a particularly unusual year, because there were very few deferred entrants, and deferred entrants, I would suspect, although I have no evidence, I suspect are more likely to come from an advantaged area than disadvantaged areas. If you can afford to go backpacking around the world for a year, you probably don't come from an inner house. Even with those caveats, it does look as though we are beginning to make an impact on one of the most difficult most challenging of the situations, social mix, if you like, in our most selective universities. I'm sure you'll know the figures about the University of Oxford better than me, but just taking the figures from the university's own access agreement, the University of Oxford said in 2010 that 6% of their students came from the most disadvantaged socioeconomic background, and the target for 2016 is for 9% of the students of this university to come from that group. A significant advance of 50% increase, but that would still leave less than 50% of the national average of people from disadvantaged socioeconomic background in universities, which stands at 19%. And even that, of course, is less than the average across all social groups, because the participation of the young cohort participation was in 2009 about 43%. So there's still some way for Oxford to go, even if it does achieve its targets. And there are a number of challenges, some of them I'm sure you will be far better informed about than I am. Some of the challenges are about aspiration. We'll see that not every teacher encourages students to apply to this university. Many people think that they can't get here, and they don't aspire. There are some real challenges with regard to achievement. If you're going to set 3 A's as a typical entry qualification, then you'll find that there aren't that many students from this group who actually achieve 3 A's at A level. There's some challenges with regard to subject choices. There are a plethora of A-level choices out there, and students from disadvantaged backgrounds don't have the access to the information, advice and guidance that they might need to choose the right subjects, the ones which you look for when applications come in. There are some interesting features about course choices that people make to come to the most selective of universities. I recently got pilloried in the Sunday Times for pointing out that ethnic minority students were much more likely to apply for some of the toughest courses to gain admission to in this university and other highly selective universities. That is often cited as one of the reasons for under-participation by ethnic minorities in this and other highly selective universities. And I've already mentioned the importance of information, advice and guidance on subject choices, but it's also important for people to have an understanding of the peculiarities of the Oxford system. If I get confused about the college system, can you imagine what somebody from a non-background which has no connection with the universities does? The interview can be a real challenge for some, whereas for others from more advantaged backgrounds, they're sending people to this university and they have good training in their interviews. There are, of course, a host of organisations out there who are attempting to do some things about part of that. One of the organisations I've come into contact with, which I must say I admire greatly, is Target Oxbridge, which is attempting to make sure that more black and black origin students are able to access this university. And they gave me some figures when I first came to the job, saying that 2.3% of the student body in this country that gets three A's or better at A level are black or black origin students. But only 1% of this university of Cambridge students were black or black origin home students in 2011. I was delighted to get some figures this week which suggest that with regard to admissions in 2012, UCAS is saying that 2.3% of Oxbridge students were of black or black origin, suggesting that whatever it was that was an impediment for those who actually achieved the grades and who wanted to come to this university were not actually getting in. And so I was delighted to hear that, and maybe there are people here who know more about how it is that's been overcome in terms of, I think, both greater preparation of students by organisations like Target Oxbridge, but also perhaps a better understanding of the particular cultural challenges that group face in admissions to this university. So some good stories to tell, but there are still apparently some barriers. There's still significant different distribution across different universities and colleges, and of course different universities very clearly face different issues, and that's why it's important to respect institutional autonomy master and to allow people to write their own access agreement with their own targets. But you should expect some challenge on that because you'll need to explain to me why it is you have set the targets you have and why it is you feel those are the appropriate ones for this university. But it is a shared responsibility. It is not something that just universities can do alone. They need to work closely with colleges and schools and teachers. There's an important role for parents, and indeed there's a role for employers to explain the importance of university and of university courses and what they look for. And we have, in our latest guidance, emphasised the importance of collaboration between institutions. The work that this university does in encouraging widening participation as a flagship university is important. It has a knock-on effect. Well, everybody that you reach out to and encourage to aspire will necessarily get here. But if you encourage them to aspire to university, you make a contribution to widening participation, and we will recognise that in offer and in the work that you do. We've been asked by the Minister to develop a joint strategy with the Higher Education Funding Council for England, and we have submitted that to him, and indeed interim report of how that's going. But we recognise that it's not just a shared responsibility between Hoffa and Hefke, but it is something which is shared across the whole sector and with these other groups as well. I should say that there will be some definite benefits to institutions. One of the things used to annoy me as a Vice-Chancellor was having to write separate reports on voluntary participation for both Hoffa and Hefke. They'll now be in the same document, but I can't tell you they'll all be in the same table because there is different statutory requirements on what Hoffa has to collect and what Hefke has to collect. But at least they'll be in the same document. You'll be thinking about them at the same time. They'll be based on the same base and the same group of students. And I think that will be both more helpful to regulators, but also more helpful to institutions and less time consuming. So universities are engaged in a lot of activities, and we pick that up from the access agreements and from the things that I talk about. What are the things which highly selective universities can most do? Summer schools are an important part of outreach programs, and targeting summer schools on disadvantaged students is a proven successful activity. We have been advocating quite strongly since I came in as director, extended outreach. That certainly has to reach out before GCSE for a university like this, because some choices are made in subject choices at GCSE which eliminate Oxford as an option for some students. And so the outreach has got to be pre-GCSE. We actually believe it needs to be long-term and sustained, reaching right down to primary school. Universities can spend their money on outreach, on financial support for students, fee waivers, bursaries, and they can also spend that money, their access money as it were, on student success, on activities which promote retention or attainment or employability for target groups. We want to be sure that the money is being spent effectively and well, we think that there's probably been in the past an underspend on outreach activity given the growing evidence that it is the most effective activity that institutions can engage in. We also need more openness and transparency. That's why we publish all the access agreements on our website. But it's also important, I think, for universities to publicise their success to encourage others and also to talk openly about the challenges that they face, and to share good practice between universities. I think it's very incumbent upon certainly research-intensive universities to conduct research in this area, because research underpins what you do in a university, and sound evaluation is important for the size of money that universities are investing in this activity. Outreach is certainly one of the key areas that we have been saying that we want universities to engage in, because it does raise aspiration, it does make young people think if they can do it, so can I. It does meet the significant gap that there still is about information about what the new funding system is in this country. Very large numbers of students still don't claim the bursaries that they're entitled to, and we need to get much more information. I still hear people say, how am I going to be able to afford £9,000 a year? The message has still not got out about fee loans and about the repayment terms. That information and that outreach needs to get in early before key decisions are made, and it needs to be sustained. The one-off event is not as effective as a sustained interaction. Yesterday evening I was celebrating the 10th anniversary of Into University. Into University is an example of a third sector activity. There are some 12,000 students at Into University now, works with in London and Nottingham, and they start in primary schools. I've seen some of their events with primary schools and the work that they do. And the amazing thing is that 71% of the students that go on the into university program progress to university. That is that you should compare with 80% from the same group of children who've not been to into university. It's expensive, but the cost per child they estimate is per child per year is £200, they've been generously supported by a number of big city institutions. I must say I'm impressed with the work that they do, because it is sustained and it starts young and it continues. And of course, greater authorities than me have said it's important that universities should work with schools and ensure that outreach programs are reached down into primary schools. Well, I know that Oxford is indeed heavily engaged with schools. Over 2,000 activities involving 3,000 schools and colleges in 2010-11. That was an increase of some 27% on the previous year. And you have a regional link program, which means that particular colleges focus on particular geographical areas. That seems to me to be important. I recognise the challenge in a global university of outreach programmes. I have to confess it was much easier when I was Vice President of the University of Bedfordshire. I had a very identifiable catchment in which to work, and the outreach was easier. I didn't have to worry about a national outreach programme, and I appreciate that you do, and the regional link programme seems to me to be one of the ways in which you can achieve that. We're particularly interested to find out about the work going on at University College here. One of the first, if not the first, college to establish a schools liaison access officer. And we have a large program of access and outreach initiatives. Some 40 student ambassadors, some of whom I know are here tonight, and I know are doing a great job in schools. When schools come in on schools visits, the ambassadors do the tour and the presentation and take questions and answer. And they even entertain to lunch in hall. The student ambassadors are interested in going out to schools, which is it's key to bring people in, to demystify university life, but it's key also to go out to where people are. And again, the ambassadors give presentations, Q&A sessions, help with personal statements, which can be particularly challenging for students from disadvantaged backgrounds. Some help with interview skills, again, something that I've mentioned earlier is important. And just generally, help with the myth-busting, which is around about highly selective universities, particularly this university. And I understand a particular highlight of the year is the Sheffield Roadshow. Some of you spent some time in Sheffield. I was interested to hear about it. You sent a team up to Sheffield for 3 to 4 days. I hope that's not in the middle of winter, and interact with the main schools in the area. And I know that the ambassadors are encouraged to be entrepreneurial, because students are much more likely to know what's going to work these days in schools than people my age or even half my age, they come up with their own ideas about the work that student ambassadors do, and that the work in this college has been often taken as a model for Oxford University. I'm going to quote another set of work, access work from a different college in Oxford. I'm a little bit nervous about this because I know the rivalry that goes on in colleges here. But frankly, they gave me a fabulous set of slides and I can't resist using them. And this is the work that Pembroke College do in Hackney with the B6 college. The B6 College is not quite as old as Pembroke College, but a collaboration has been going on since 2008 between these two very different organisations. and the programme is you were selected to be on the programme, and it includes a summer school here. It includes information, advice and guidance, and it includes an insight into the particular educational approaches that this university is world famous for. It's part of a programme which is funded by of Hackney, which now has some 16 partner universities involved, with many subject pathways now available, some 20 different pathways, in a Raising Aspirations programme, which, as I say, includes these opportunities in this particular programme. And it really is making a difference in terms of people who would not previously have thought of applying to Oxford actually applying to come here to, in this case, to read history and politics. And it's an intensive program which is trying to, as I say, raise aspirations, and has seen a 500% rise in applications to Russell Group universities, and indeed three of the students engaged in the programme have already come to Oxford. In fact, particular figures here, looking at the Oxbridge applications, 9 of the 23 students in the cohort applied for Oxbridge, 7 of them got interviews, quite a high percentage for applicants, and 5 of them received offers. And I know Peter Klaus is very proud of the way in which the programme has brought students actually here to Oxford. And it's spread across a number of different schools in Hackney. And these, I think, are the 5 successful students, and the only thing I'll say is that I can't remember when I was a kid the sign of the Hackney Empire being Hackney. We all knew where the Hackney Empire was without having a sign. But there's an actual physical presence, a bit of Oxford at B6, and this is some of it. I don't think the bottom picture is a picture of Ed Miliband singing. as I said, there are a number of different pathways and subject centres, and indeed the programme is also spreading out, I understand, to Manchester, which I guess is another area that Pembroke pick up under the Regional Links programme. And as I say, it is significantly improving the achievement of students in Hackney, contributing to their improved success rate, and it's seen a remarkable increase in the number of applications and entry, indeed, to Russell Group universities. Going back to more general activity, there's a collaboration here with Oxford and Cambridge on student conferences. Very important to bring students in for them to explain how the system works. And there are only 10,000 potential applicants in year 12 come each year, but also some teachers and guidance advisors so that they can spread the message and understand it. I particularly like the Pathways programme because it's longitudinal. It does last from years 10 to 11. I know a group of colleges are engaged in it, targeting schools which don't traditionally send students to Oxford. Last year, 436 students had a study day here, 600 students had a taster day. I assume you don't work so hard on the taster day. I know that there was funding from the Sutton Trust as well as from the university. Now, I mentioned earlier that we know that not every teacher advises their students to Oxford. In 2012, Maury did some research for the Sutton Trust, which showed that only 44% of teachers would recommend their most able students to apply to Oxford and Cambridge. There clearly is a challenge here in perception amongst teachers, either that it's impossible to gain entry here, or that it wouldn't be sufficiently welcoming here. And that's something that now it's been exposed, you're doing something about in terms of the regional teacher conferences, seven of them held last year, reaching out to 500 teachers, hopefully explaining that you are welcoming and you are looking for students to come from those areas, and that they will be successful when they gain admission to this university. I was privileged in the summer to come along to a unique summer school. I think either Mike Nicholson or the Vice Chancellor carefully spotted a day when there was a science one going on, and the only thing which went wrong is they wouldn't let me do the experiment. I know that these have been remarkably successful, and they were very stimulating indeed, and I certainly would have applied if I had the right grades. Some 3,400 applicants in 2010, applied for 657 places, and the people were selected for that using contextual information, as the jargon goes. People from disadvantaged backgrounds had the opportunity to take up those places. And of those students, some 60% who came on the unique summer school actually made an application to this university, and some 30% received an offer, which actually just showed this is making a significant impact, and is a very good way to use contextual information, very different from the way that the Daily Mail portrays it as being used. This is actually raising aspiration, raising achievement, and is working successfully. And it's an excellent example of how you can use the information which is available about educational disadvantage. I should say that Ofwat is interested in the success of students from wider participation backgrounds when they become university students. That they successfully complete the course, that they reach their full potential, and indeed they're prepared well for work. I know is important here. I was impressed that when I met to talk with colleagues at this university about wider participation, the career staff of the university were well represented, because the job isn't just done at university, it is about continuing a professional life. Now, I said I'd say something about the expenditures on different activities. The expenditures on outreach activity and retention activity is going up under the new scheme from a relatively low level, although those are in hundreds of thousands of pounds. We are seeing an increase, and as the new system of funding reaches maturity in 2016-17, institutions say they'll be spending over £200 million on access activity, on retention and outreach. But the total investment, even in 2012-13, was £442 million. And the vast majority of that was spent on either fee waivers or bursaries and scholarships, or student choice, and that clearly is a large sum of money. If we don't have evidence that's making a big difference. Student choice is whether a student has a choice between a fee waiver or a bursary. And in fact, nearly 500,000 students from underrepresented groups received a bursary or scholarship in our universities in 2010-11. But there is little evidence that that makes any difference. Indeed, the evidence from the time of the £3,000 fees was the bursary made no difference to the decision to go to university or the choice of university. We don't know whether it made a difference in successful completion, because it was money in the pocket of students, maybe they had to work a bit less and they had more time on course, so we don't know that. Neither do we know whether £9,000 fees will change attitudes compared to £3,000 fees. Generally, it does seem, given that evidence, that the balance of expenditure on 74% of expenditure on student support of one kind or another, compared to just 26% outreach and retention, is a little bit perverse. Clearly, given the excellent retention and success rate in this university, in this college, one wouldn't expect to see a need to have a great increase in expenditure on retention, but I think an increase in expenditure on outreach would make a very big difference and really increase and enhance the work that you do. But that's your decision as to what to do. But there is a lot of money in play now, some 809.5 £1 million will be spent on access activity of one sort or another by the time the new system reaches maturity. As I said, the vast majority of it, financial support to students, and that is one of the challenges the sector has, as to whether the evidence is that more of that money could be more successfully spent on outreach activity. We are beginning to see the first evidence that the changes to student funding have not been disastrous as far as students of disadvantaged backgrounds are in terms of applying to university. We wait to see what happens in terms of attending and being successful. There are many different reasons why students apply to different universities and are successful in getting in, and not all of those things are under the control of universities. We desperately need to know what works and what doesn't work in this world. And David Willetts has charged us with finding more and more evidence about what works and what doesn't work. And of course, it is true that in a diverse sector, you'd expect people to come up with a whole series of different answers, because one size fits all is not appropriate. We'll be doing more in-house research. We've doubled our capability in that area. We'll be looking more for evidence of institutions' own evaluation, and we'll be looking to work together with other research organisations in higher education to get more evidence about what works. We're hoping that people will be putting more evaluation into their access agreements estimate more of the performance of their access measures, and what progress is being made underneath the headline targets. And indeed, using that information on determining where to spend what is a large slice of money for universities to invest in their own money to make £109.5 million. And we have pointed out in our latest guidance there is a virtuous circle in evaluation that improves the effectiveness of what you do. We are keen to see students more engaged in design, implementation, and monitoring of access agreements and arrangements. The students have, in fact, introduced a number of innovative approaches to this work. We've said in a guidance we sent out for 2014-15 access agreements, we want an increased emphasis on evidence and evaluation. We want agreements to be more strategic. We're continuing this theme of greater challenge and greater support. We're expecting to see a growth in outreach activity. We're encouraging collaboration. We are pushing for equality and diversity targets about how they're looking at the greater emphasis on the student voice. We're looking I emphasise this because a lot of people say, oh, you don't care much about collaboration and partnership. Well, we do, and it's very clearly stated in our latest guidance. But I want to leave the last word to the Minister to say that, just as he says, it's not about social engineering. I believe that this challenge that we have about access, fair access to our universities, particularly universities like this, is a crucial challenge for us. This is a globally competitive university. You must have access to the full talent in this country to remain at that level of global competitiveness. Our economy is competing as never before in a globally competitive economy. We have to have the very brightest of talents in this country if we're going to continue to be successful as a nation. We live in a very diverse society now, and in terms of equity and social cohesion, we have to meet the challenge of fair access. And above all, I believe passionately, because my life was transformed by higher education, that higher education at this university is particularly life-transforming, and I want to encourage you in all the work that you do to promote fair access in this college and in this university, and to thank and congratulate those of you who've made the advances I've talked about, and to hear your suggestions of how we can do things even better in the future. Thank you.